Part 4. Assessing the End of the World. Chapter 8. Is it good to make happy people? Derek Parfit. Derek Parfit was one of the most creative and influential moral philosophers of the last century, a machine for turning coffee into philosophical insights. He lived almost all of his life in educational institutions, attending Eton on a scholarship before studying history at Oxford, then winning a prize fellowship at All Souls College. All Souls might be the most exclusive research institute in the world. There are no undergraduates and fewer than 10 graduate students at any one time. The qualifying tests for the fellowship have been called the hardest exam in the world. 12 hours of domain-specific and general questions and prompts such as, what is a number? Can we be forced to be free? And even, defend tweeting. Up until recently, there was a further 3-hour exam that simply presented you with a single word, such as water, novelty, or reproduction, and required you to write a full essay on the topic. After receiving the fellowship at age 24, Parfit spent the next 43 years at All Souls, and never completed any of his philosophy degrees. He was utterly single-minded in his pursuit of improving our moral understanding. In the latter half of his life, he would take every opportunity to save time on anything that wasn't philosophy. Literally running between seminars, wearing the same outfit every day, black trousers and a white shirt, and eating the same easy-to-prepare vegetarian meals, cereal with yogurt and blackberries for breakfast, for dinner, raw carrots, romaine lettuce, celery dipped in peanut butter or hummus, followed by tangerines and apples. He would read philosophy while brushing his teeth. The coffee he drank was instant, filled from the hot water tap, so that he didn't have to wait for the kettle to boil. As New Yorker journalist Larissa McFarquhar noted in her profile of him, the driving force behind Parfit's moral concern was suffering. He couldn't bear to see someone suffer. Even thinking about suffering in the abstract could make him cry. His capacity for philosophy and his generosity were boundless. As your graduate student, I once provided him with comments on a draft article of his. I thought these were rather lengthy at 3,000 words. Even so, a typical response from a senior professor would be, "Thanks." Parfit, however, quickly responded with 9,000 words, about the length of a typical journal article. He apologized for the length, telling me he had taken some time to shorten it. Tragically, he passed away in early 2017. Parfit inaugurated several new areas of moral philosophy. The one that has most shaped my worldview, and which is covered in this chapter, is population ethics, the evaluation of actions that might change who is born, how many people are born, and what their quality of life will be. Secular discussion of this topic is strikingly scarce. Despite thousands of years of ethical thought, the issue was only discussed briefly by the early utilitarians and their critics in the late 18th and 19th centuries, and it received sporadic attention in the years that followed. The watershed moment came in 1984 with the publication of Parfit's book, Reasons and Persons. Population ethics is crucial for long-termism because it greatly affects how we should evaluate the end of civilization. Parfit himself recognized this, writing at the very end of Reasons and Persons, "I believe that if we destroy mankind, as we now could, this outcome would be much worse than most people think." Compare three outcomes. 1. Peace. 2. A nuclear war that kills 99% of the world's existing population. 3. A nuclear war that kills 100%. Outcome 2 would be worse than 1, and 3 would be worse than 2. Which is the greater of these two differences? Most people believe that the greater difference is between 1 and 2. I believe that the difference between 2 and 3 is very much greater. The reason that Parfit regarded extinction as far worse even than a catastrophe that killed 99% of the global population is that extinction would not just involve the deaths of the 8 billion people alive today. It would also prevent the existence of all the people who otherwise would have lived in the generations to come. The end of civilization would mean the absence of trillions upon trillions of people who would otherwise have been born. Parfit concluded that preventing the existence of a happy and flourishing life is a moral loss. The loss from human extinction is therefore vast. In later work, he concluded that what now matters most is that we avoid ending human history. When I first came across the idea of regarding the prevented existence of a happy life as a moral loss, I found it bizarrely unintuitive. Over time, the force of arguments in favour of this view changed my mind. Indeed, this is one of the most significant ways in which moral philosophy has changed my ethical views, and I think that Parfit's arguments, and the arguments of others in the field of population ethics, are among the most important contributions of moral philosophy of the last century. In this chapter, I'm going to explain these arguments and defend Parfit's view that, provided a person had a sufficiently good life, the world would be a better place in virtue of that person being born and living that life. Crucially, this isn't the claim that an additional person might make the world better by enriching the lives of others. Instead, it's the claim that having one extra person in the world is good in and of itself, if that person is sufficiently happy. So, throughout most of this chapter, I will bracket questions around the harms that people might impose by using resources or producing pollution, or the benefits they might produce by creating life-saving inventions. While these are important factors, I am concerned not with the instrumental effects of additional people, but with the question of whether adding sufficiently happy people is non-instrumentally or intrinsically good. I also do not claim that we are morally required to bring more happy people into existence, or that we're blameworthy if we fail to do so. Just that, all other things being equal, having more happy people makes the world a better place. Before we begin, allow me a few caveats. The first is that this is going to be the most theoretical chapter in the book. Population ethics is recognized as one of the most complex areas of moral philosophy, and at universities, it is normally studied only at the graduate level. To my knowledge, these ideas haven't been presented to a general audience before. But they are of such great importance for thinking about the long-term future that I simply must discuss them. I will do my best to simplify things, but the subject matter itself is often complex and confusing. As will become clear in what follows, all theories of population ethics have some unintuitive or unappealing implications. The task is to decide which unappealing implications we must accept. Second, I'll talk a lot about people's well-being or happiness. I use the terms interchangeably. By this I mean how well or poorly someone's entire life goes, not just how well off someone is at a specific moment in time. I'll sometimes use numbers to represent how well off someone is. When I do, I'll use 100 to refer to an extraordinarily good life, happy and flourishing. I'll use minus 100 to refer to an extraordinarily bad life, full of misery and suffering. And I'll use 0 to refer to a life that's neither good nor bad from the perspective of the person living it. Crucially, I'm not assuming anything about the nature of well-being. A good life could consist of joyful experiences, or meaningful accomplishments, or the pursuit of knowledge and beauty, or the satisfaction of one's preferences, or all of these things combined. Whichever of these views we have, we need to think about population ethics. Third, in this chapter, I'll talk about lives that are below neutral well-being. Lives such that it would be better, for the people living them, if they had never been born. This can be a disturbing idea, and I've met people who claimed that it is simply not possible for a life to be below neutral well-being. But that cannot be correct. Recall the most extreme suffering you have ever experienced, and imagine a life that consisted of nothing but that suffering. Would you choose to live that life if the alternative was non-existence? If you answer no, that suggests you agree that, in principle, a life can be below neutral well-being. Importantly, that someone has a life with below neutral well-being does not entail that their life is not worth living. Even if a person is persistently depressed, They can make a great contribution to the world by being a good friend or family member, by being a doctor or a scientist producing life-saving research. And if someone has below neutral well-being at a particular time, that does not mean that their whole life is below neutral. Almost everyone goes through periods of sadness and depression, but that does not mean that their whole life has been negative for them. Fourth, when I talk about populations, I mean total populations. Not just how many people are alive at a specific time, but all people across all time. Finally, to test different theories in population ethics, I will evaluate what they say about how we should compare different populations. In practice, we will probably never get to make choices between such populations, but considering these hypothetical cases is still the best way to assess whether a theory is true. As I hope will become clear by the end of the chapter, this is not all merely idle philosophical speculation. It really does matter for ordinary people and governments which theory of population ethics is true. With these clarifications established, we can look at some different perspectives on population ethics. The intuition of neutrality. The view that the world is made better by having more people with sufficiently good lives is often regarded as unintuitive. Philosopher Jan Narveson put it in slogan form: we are in favour of making people happy, but neutral about making happy people. One of my PhD supervisors, economist turned philosopher John Broom, called this the intuition of neutrality, the idea that bringing someone with a good life into existence is a neutral matter. While writing a book on population ethics, Broom struggled for over a decade trying to justify it before grudgingly accepting that it had to be abandoned. I too had this intuition and was reluctant to reject it. You might feel this intuition if you reflect on how you'd reason when deciding whether to have a child. You might think through many reasons in favour or against. Whether it would make your life and the lives of your family members happier and more meaningful. Whether the child would, through their good deeds, go on to improve society. Perhaps you would think about your child's carbon footprint. But you might think it would be odd to claim that the fact that the child would have a good life is itself a reason to have a child. If you endorse the intuition of neutrality, then ensuring that our future is good while civilization persists might seem much more important than ensuring our future is long. You would still think that safeguarding civilization is good, because doing so reduces the risk of death for those alive today. And you might still put great weight on the loss of future artistic and scientific accomplishments that the end of civilization would entail. But you wouldn't regard the absence of future generations in itself as a moral loss. However, there are many situations where the intuition of neutrality is very unintuitive. This is clearest when we imagine lives consisting entirely of misery and suffering. Imagine a life that, from birth till death, consists only of agony and anguish. Imagine, for example, someone who continually felt like they were being burned alive. And imagine that you know you could have a child who would live such a life. It seems entirely obvious to me that having this child would be a bad thing to do. For this reason, most philosophers who endorse the intuition of neutrality endorse an asymmetry. They believe that, although it's not good to bring a new person with a happy life into existence, it is bad to bring a new person with an unhappy life into existence. But it's not clear how we can justify this asymmetry, though many philosophers have tried. If we think it's bad to bring into existence a life of suffering, why should we not think that it's good to bring into existence a flourishing life? I think any argument for the first claim would also be a good argument for the second. This idea becomes more plausible when we think of lives that are sufficiently good. For example, I have one nephew and two nieces, who are all still young. They are happy children, and if I imagine this happiness continuing into their futures, if I imagine they'll each live a rewarding life full of love and accomplishment, and ask myself, is the world at least a little better because of their existence, even ignoring their effects on others? It becomes quite intuitive to me that the answer is yes. If so, the intuition of neutrality is wrong. Philosophers often claim that the intuition of neutrality is part of the common sense moral view, but really it's not clear that this is true. The only psychological study on this topic asked participants how much better or worse the world would be if one new person were added to it. In one variant of the question, it was stipulated that the new person would be extremely happy and live a life full of bliss and joy. In the other variant, the new person would be extremely unhappy and live a life full of suffering and misery. It was emphasized that there would be no other negative or positive impacts on others from the existence of this person. The authors of the study found that people, on average, think that it's a good thing to bring a new happy person into existence, and that it's a bad thing to bring a new unhappy person into existence. Moreover, these judgments were symmetrical. The experimental subjects were just as positive about the idea of bringing into existence a new happy person as they were negative about the idea of bringing into existence a new unhappy person. That is, those surveyed did not have the intuition of neutrality. Clumsy gods, the fragility of identity. A second argument against the intuition of neutrality again comes from Parfit. He noted that our existence in the world is exceptionally unlikely, and the identity of future people is exceptionally fragile, and that major ethical implications follow from this. Time travel stories often illustrate how the present can be highly dependent on small decisions in the past. In Back to the Future, for example, Marty McFly goes back in time, takes his mother to a high school dance, sets her up with his father, and helps his father defeat Biff, the school bully. Though his parents ultimately marry, preserving Marty's existence, when he returns to the present, there are some major changes to his life. His dad is a successful writer, and Biff, instead of bullying his father, as he did before Marty time-traveled, cleans his family's car. But I think that if we consider the changes to the past that Marty McFly made, the changes to his present life would have been much greater than the film suggests. Consider that a typical ejaculation contains around 200 million sperm. If any of the other 200 million sperm had fertilized the egg that you developed from, then you would not have been born. Instead, someone else, with 75% of your genes, would have been born in your place. A 1 in 200 million event involves extreme luck. So, as much as I'm sure you don't want to think about such things, if your father's ejaculation had occurred just milliseconds earlier or later, it would almost certainly have been a different sperm that fertilized your mother's egg. And so any event that affected the schedules of your biological mother and father on the day that you were conceived, even if only by a tiny amount, such as a longer line at the supermarket or an additional car ahead of them on their way home from work, would have prevented you from being born. When Marty McFly returns to the present, his siblings are the same people they were before his time travel adventure, if more successful. But if he really had gone back in time and made any changes at all to his parents' lives, he would have changed his siblings' identities, and, paradoxically, his own. If someone else had been born in your place, this would have had countless knock-on effects. Your siblings' time of birth would probably have been different, as would their personality. They would have altered how your parents and people who interacted with your parents behaved over the course of decades. And all those interactions would have altered the timings of countless other reproductive events, changing which sperm met the eggs and altering the identities of the babies who were subsequently born. These changes would also have impacted the timing of further reproductive events, until at some point in the future, the identities of everyone who was born is different than they would have been. And this is all because of small decisions, like which route home your parents took from work one day. I dedicated my first book, Doing Good Better, to Peter Singer, Toby Ord, and Stanislav Petrov, and I said that, without them, this book would not have been written. But the book also would not have been written were it not for Jesus, Hitler, or any random English peasant in the 15th century. In time travel stories, small actions in the past often result in radical changes in the present. But we rarely think about the fact that small actions today can have dramatic effects on the future. Do the very long-term consequences of our actions fade out over time, like ripples on a pond? No. Rather, every year, like clumsy gods, we radically change the course of history. For example, if you live in a city, then by choosing to take public transport to work and back, rather than drive, over the course of a year, you will ever so slightly impact the schedules of tens of thousands of people over hundreds of days. Statistically, it's likely that, on one out of those tens of thousands of person days, the person you impacted had sex and conceived a child later than that day, and you affected, ever so slightly, the timing of that conception, changing which sperm met the egg, and thus changing who was born. That different person will then impact the schedules of millions of other people, changing what children they have, and so on, in an identity cascade. Past a certain date, everyone who is ever born will be different from who would have been born if you had chosen to drive instead, and the entire course of future history will be different. Wars will be fought that would never have been fought, monuments built that would never have been built, works of literature written that would never have been written, all because you chose to take the bus rather than drive. The fragility of identity has important philosophical implications. Suppose that the world's governments decide to end fossil fuel subsidies. Intuitively, we might think that by reducing climate change, this decision improves the lives of specific people in the future who would exist either way. But this is incorrect. A large policy change like this would impact everyone in the world. It would make petrol more expensive, and so would affect traffic globally. It would change everyone's schedules, and by affecting the timing of conceptions, within a few years it would change the identities of almost every person who was born. From a few years onwards, the new population will be made up of entirely different people than those who would have otherwise existed. These people will be better off than those who would have existed had we kept fossil fuel subsidies, but they will be different people. And according to the intuition of neutrality, we cannot make the world better by adding new people. So we cannot say that ending fossil fuels is good because it benefits future generations. Consider two people, Alice and Bob. If we keep fossil fuel subsidies, Alice will be born in 2070. If we end fossil fuel subsidies, Alice will not be born and Bob will be born instead. Both have happy lives, but because climate change will be less extreme without fossil fuel subsidies, Bob will be happier than Alice would have been. According to the intuition of neutrality, we do not have reason to ensure that Bob exists rather than Alice. According to the intuition of neutrality, preventing Alice's existence is neither good nor bad, and bringing Bob into existence is also neither good nor bad. So doing both at once is neither good nor bad. This implication of the intuition of neutrality seems wrong. Intuitively, the fact that ending fossil fuel subsidies will change the identities of future people just doesn't matter morally. The reasons the world's governments have to end fossil fuels are just as strong, whether or not they will change who exists in the future. Ending fossil fuel subsidies makes the future better, but it does so by creating a population that is made up of completely different people than the population that would have existed otherwise. Adding new people cannot, then, be a neutral matter. Why the intuition of neutrality is wrong. So far, we've seen arguments for thinking that the intuition of neutrality is much less intuitive than it might first seem. But there is also a powerful argument in favour of that view based on what is a surprisingly simple piece of logic. Suppose that a couple are deciding whether or not to have a child. Because of a vitamin deficiency that the mother is currently suffering from, the child they conceive will certainly suffer from migraine. Every few months, for their entire life, they will suffer a debilitating headache and have fatigue and brain fog for several days afterwards. But other than this, the child will live a good and full life. According to the intuition of neutrality, it is a neutral matter whether or not these parents have this child. The world is equally good either way. Now suppose that the parents also have the option of having the child a few months later. At that later point, the mother will no longer suffer from the vitamin deficiency, and the child they conceive will not suffer from migraine as a result. Let's call the option of having no child, no child. Migraine is the option of having a child with migraines, and migraine-free is the option of having a child without migraine. It seems obvious that, as long as there are no other considerations in play, if the parents have the choice, they should choose to have a child that's migraine-free over the child with migraine. That is, migraine-free is better than migraine. But if so, then the intuition of neutrality must be wrong. Having a child cannot be a neutral matter. To see this, first compare no child and migraine. According to the intuition of neutrality, the world is equally good either way, whether the parents decide to have no child or to have the child with migraine. That is, no child is equally as good as migraine. Second, compare no child with migraine-free. According to the intuition of neutrality, the world is equally good either way, whether the parents decide to have no child or to have the child without migraines. That is, no child is equally as good as migraine-free. However, if no child is equally as good as migraine, and no child is equally as good as migraine-free, then migraine and migraine-free must be equally good. But we know that having the child with migraine is worse than having the child without migraine. The two outcomes are exactly the same, except that in one outcome, one person has more suffering in their life. The intuition of neutrality has led us into a contradiction. Various philosophers have now spent several decades playing argumentative whack-a-mole, trying to avoid the problems with the intuition of neutrality. It's impossible to do justice to all these potential responses, especially as the ensuing discussion gets very technical very quickly. But in my view, all proposed defences of the intuition of neutrality suffer from devastating objections. If we give up on the intuition of neutrality, what should we have instead? Parfit himself didn't know. He called the quest for the correct theory of population ethics the quest for Theory X. Let's turn to a few candidates for such a theory. The average view. You might be tempted to suggest that what's important is to try to increase a population's average well-being. In this view, it's better to have 50,000 people at plus 60 happiness than to have 400,000 at plus 40 happiness. This is a view that's often assumed, implicitly or explicitly, by economists. And surveys suggest that it seems to have a basis in common sense. However, though philosophers agree on very few things, one of the things they do agree on is that the average view is wrong. It suffers from an absolute litany of problems. Here are just two. First, if the world consisted of a million people whose lives were filled with excruciating suffering, one could make the world better by adding another million people whose lives were also filled with excruciating suffering, as long as the suffering of the new people was ever so slightly less bad than the suffering of the original people. This is a thought experiment that Parfit presented and referred to as Hell 3. If the original 1 million people have minus 100 well-being, then in the average view, adding a further million people at well-being level minus 99.9 is a good thing because it brings up the average. But this is absurd. The second problem is that in the average view, it can be better to create new lives filled with suffering than to create happy lives. Suppose that the world consists of 10 billion people at well-being 100. We could either add 10 million people in excruciating suffering at well-being minus 100, or 300 million people with happy and flourishing lives at well-being 90. Adding the 300 million people at well-being 90 would bring down the average by more than adding the 10 million people at well-being minus 100. So, in the average view, it would be better to add the 10 million lives of excruciating suffering. This, again, is absurd. Given these problems, we should not be tempted to endorse the average view. The total view. If we reject both the intuition of neutrality and the average view, the most natural alternative is the total view. In this view, one population is better than another if it contains more total well-being. The basic motivation for the total view is simply that more of a good thing is better. Good lives are good. More of a good thing is better. So increasing the number of good lives makes the world better. The primary objection to the total view is as follows. Consider two worlds. We'll call the first big and flourishing, and the second enormous and drab. Big and flourishing contains 10 billion people, all at an extremely high level of well-being. Enormous and drab has an extraordinarily large number of people, and everyone has lives that have only slightly positive well-being. If the total view is correct, then, as long as the number of people in the second world is large enough, we must conclude that the second world is better than the first. The well-being from enough lives that have slightly positive well-being can add up to more than the well-being of 10 billion people that are extremely well off. Parfit himself thought that this was a deeply unpalatable result. So unpalatable that he called it the repugnant conclusion, and the name stuck. Initially, he described those slightly positive well-being lives as consisting of listening to music and eating potatoes. Later in his life, his favoured formulation was to imagine these lives as lizards basking in the sun. The repugnant conclusion is certainly unintuitive. Does this mean that we should automatically reject the total view? I don't think so. Indeed, in what was an unusual move in philosophy, a public statement was recently published, co-signed by 29 philosophers, stating that the fact that a theory of population ethics entails the repugnant conclusion shouldn't be a decisive reason to reject that theory. I was one of the co-signatories. Though the repugnant conclusion is unintuitive, it turns out that it follows from three other premises that I would regard as close to indisputable. The first premise is that if you make everyone in a given population better off, while at the same time adding to the world people with positive well-being, then you have made the world better. This premise is known as dominance addition. The second premise is that if we compare two populations with the same number of people, and the second population has both greater average and total well-being, and that well-being is perfectly equally distributed, then that second population is better than the first. This premise is known, catchily, as non-anti-egalitarianism. The basic idea behind this premise is that equality is not actively bad. While some people deny that equality is intrinsically good, to my knowledge, no one thinks that equality makes the world worse, all other things being equal. The third premise is that if one world is better than a second world, which is itself better than a third, then the first world is better than the third. If A is better than B and B is better than C, then A is better than C. This is called transitivity. If we endorse these three premises, then we must endorse the repugnant conclusion. Consider first what I'll call world A, a world of 10 billion people who all live wonderful lives of absolute bliss and flourishing. We would, of course, regard this as a very good world. Next, consider world A+. This world differs from A in only two ways. The 10 billion people in A+ have even better lives than those in A, and the total population is larger. In A+, there are an additional 10 billion people who have pretty good lives, though much less good than the other 10 billion peoples. So in A+, there are 20 billion people in total. A+ is better than A for the people who would exist in either world, and the additional 10 billion people who would live in the A+ have good lives. So we should think that A+ is a better world than A. That's the dominance addition premise in play. Next, consider world B. In this world, there are the same number of people as in A+, but there is no longer any inequality. Everyone has the same level of well-being. What's more, in world B, the average and total well-being are greater than those of world A+. Everyone has equally good lives, and those lives are very good. just a little bit less good than the lives of the residents of A. On average and in total, people in World B are far better off than the people are in A+, and the distribution of well-being is perfectly equal, unlike the very unequal A+. So we should think that World B is better than World A+. That's the premise of non-anti-egalitarianism in play. Finally, because we thought that B was better than A+, and that A+, was better than A, we should conclude that B is better than A. That's the premise of transitivity coming in. And if we conclude that B is better than A, then we're concluding that a larger population with a lower average well-being is better than a smaller population with greater average well-being. But now notice that we can repeat the process that we just ran through. We could consider World B+, which makes the people in World B a little bit better off, and adds an extra 20 billion people with lives that are pretty good, but not as good as the original 20 billion lives. And then we could consider World C, which is just like B+, except that everyone in B+ is equally well off, at a level of well-being that is just a little bit below the best-off people in B+. And so on. We could keep iterating this process over and over, making people's average well-being a little bit lower in exchange for making the population larger. We would end up with an enormous number of people with lives that have only slightly positive well-being. And we would have to conclude that that world is better than the world we started with 10 billion lives of bliss. That is, we have arrived at the repugnant conclusion. If you want to reject the repugnant conclusion, therefore, you've got to reject one of the premises that this argument was based on. But each of these premises seem incontrovertible. We are left with a paradox. One option is simply to accept the repugnant conclusion, and perhaps argue that it is not quite as repugnant as it first seems. This is the view I incline towards. Many other philosophers believe that we should reject one of the other premises instead. Indeed, this was true of Parfit. He was not alone in this, and many philosophers have constructed theories designed to avoid the repugnant conclusion. One alternative with prominent adherents is the critical level view. The critical level view. In the critical level view, it's a good thing to bring into existence a good life, but only if that life is sufficiently good, above a certain critical level of well-being. To this, the critical level view adds the idea that it's bad to bring into existence a life that has positive well-being but is not very good. This is in contrast to the total view, in which it's always a good thing to bring into existence a life with positive well-being. In the critical level view, adding lives that have low but positive well-being is a bad thing. So the critical level view denies the dominance addition premise. This view escapes the repugnant conclusion. However, the critical level view has its own counterintuitive implications. For example, like the average view, it leads to what's called the sadistic conclusion, that it can be better to add to the world lives full of suffering than it is to add good lives. To see this, suppose that 10 represents the critical level of well-being. On the critical level view, adding 100 people at well-being level 5 to the population is worse than adding 10 people at minus 30 well-being. The critical level view regards the addition of lives that only just have positive well-being as a bad thing. So adding enough such lives can result in worse overall well-being than adding a smaller number of lives that are full of suffering. This seems wrong. Like all views in population ethics, the critical level view has some very unappealing downsides. What you ought to do when you don't know what to do. There is still deep disagreement within philosophy about what the right view of population ethics is. I think the balance of arguments favours the total view, but given how difficult the subject matter is, I'm not at all certain of this. Indeed, I don't think that there's any view in population ethics that anyone should be extremely confident in. Despite this uncertainty, we still need to act. So we need to know how to act despite our uncertainty. In Chapter 2, I introduced the idea that expected value is the right way of evaluating options in the face of uncertainty. In that chapter, I was talking about empirical uncertainty, uncertainty about what will happen. In this context, what we need is an account of decision-making when there's uncertainty about what's of value. In other work, I've argued that, at least in many circumstances, we can extend expected value theory to incorporate uncertainty about value too. In the case of population ethics, what we should do is figure out what degree of belief we ought to have in each of the different views of population ethics, and then take the action that is the best compromise between those views, the action with the highest expected value. To illustrate this, suppose you assign some probability to both the total view and the critical level view, and for simplicity's sake, let's put all other views to the side. If you're maximizing expected value, you end up following a critical level view, though with a lower level for a sufficiently good life than if you were certain about the critical level view. Suppose, for example, that you're split 50-50 between the total view and the critical level view, with the level for a sufficiently good life set at a well-being of 10. Then, if you're maximizing expected value, the effective critical level would be halfway between the level of the total view, that is 0, and the level of the critical level view, that is 10. Under this moral uncertainty, it's good to bring someone into existence if their well-being is greater than 5. But it's not good to bring someone into existence if their well-being is less than 5. My colleagues Toby Ord and Hilary Graves have found that this approach to reasoning under moral uncertainty can be extended to a range of theories of population ethics, including those that try to capture the intuition of neutrality. When you are uncertain about all of these theories, you still end up with a low but positive critical level. The benefits of having kids. In rich countries, people generally want to have more kids than they end up having. Americans, for example, want to have 2.6 children on average, but have only 1.8. In significant part, this is because work and other commitments get in the way. But increasingly, people are starting to see the choice to have children as an unethical one, because having children means greater carbon dioxide emissions and faster climate change. I think this is a mistake. Children have positive effects as well as negative ones. In addition to the direct positive impacts on their family and the friends they will make, when children grow up, they contribute to public goods through their taxes, they build infrastructure, and they develop and champion new ideas about how to live and how to structure society. In the last chapter, we saw that the recent decline in fertility might lead to a long period of stagnation, extending the time of perils. Having kids can help mitigate this risk. So far, the knock-on effects of a growing population have clearly been positive, for human beings at least. If they were not, then we would expect the recent dramatic increase in population size to be associated with ever-expanding human misery. But in fact, we've seen the opposite. Think about how much worse the world would be if Benjamin Lay, Frederick Douglass, and Harriet Tubman had never existed, or if Marie Curie, Ada Lovelace, or Isaac Newton had never been born. Remember, you are population too. If you think you have made the world a better place, then you must think that new people can as well. In addition to the positive knock-on effects of having children, if your children have lives that are sufficiently good, then your decision to have them is good for them. With a sufficiently good upbringing, having a chance to experience this world is a benefit. And by the same token, if you have grandchildren, you benefit them too. Of course, whether to have children is a deeply personal choice. I don't think that we should scold those who choose not to, and I certainly don't think that the government should restrict people's reproductive rights by, for example, limiting access to contraception or banning abortion. But given the benefits of having children and raising them well, I do think that we could start to once again see having kids as a way of positively contributing to the world. Just as you can live a good life by being helpful to those around you, donating to charity, or working in a socially valuable career, I think you can live a good life by raising a family and being a loving parent. Bigger is better. Population ethics might change how we view the benefits of having a family, but that is not its main implication. The most important upshot of population ethics concerns the question, how bad is the end of civilization? Should we care about the loss of those future people who will never be born if humanity goes extinct in the next few centuries? We now have our tentative answer. Yes, it is a loss if future people are prevented from coming into existence, as long as their lives would be good enough. So the early extinction of the human race would be a truly enormous tragedy. In fact, the conclusion that follows is more general than this. If future civilization will be good enough, then we should not merely try to avoid near-term extinction. We should also hope that future civilization will be big. If future people will be sufficiently well off, then a civilization that is twice as long or twice as large is twice as good. The practical upshot of this is a model case for space settlement. Though Earth-based civilization could last for hundreds of millions of years, the stars will still be shining in trillions of years' time, and a civilization that is spread out across many solar systems could last at least this long. And civilization could be expansive as well as long. Our sun is just one of 100 billion stars in the Milky Way. The Milky Way is one of just 20 billion galaxies in the affectable universe. The future of civilization could be literally astronomical in scale. And if we will achieve a thriving, flourishing society, then it would be of enormous importance to make it so. That doesn't mean we should pursue space settlement now. Space settlement might well be a point of lock-in. The norms, laws, and distribution of power that are present at the time of the first settlers could determine who has access to which celestial bodies and how they are used. By not rushing headlong into space settlement, we preserve option value, ensuring we have time to design systems of governance that don't merely replicate today's injustices far into the future. And there are more urgent priorities too. Contemporary efforts to explore the solar system, like the Curiosity, Perseverance, and Zhurong rovers on Mars, can be important for advancing science and for inspiring humanity. But the key practical implication of this chapter is that we should focus on preventing the threats of catastrophe that face us this century, so that we have any chance at all of building a flourishing interstellar society in the centuries that follow. Moreover, the if that all this discussion is based on is a big one. If the future will be sufficiently good. It might not be. Let's look at this in the next chapter.